This is an ABC podcast.
G'day, I'm David Lipson, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Coming up on This Week, we finally have the question that'll be put to Australians at a referendum on whether to create an Indigenous voice to Parliament and government. So what's at stake in the campaign to come? And New South Wales is heading to the polls in the midst of a cost of living crisis. Will the government change for the first time in 12 years? But first, there were ugly scenes in several capital cities this week, and the common thread was the issue of transgender rights. In Canberra, firebrand Senator Lydia Thorpe was pushed to the ground by police as she attempted to interrupt an anti-trans rally. In Sydney, there were violent scenes outside a Catholic church where One Nation's Mark Latham was giving a speech about LGBTQI activism. There were also protests in Hobart and Adelaide, but an incident in Melbourne shocked Victorians when 30 masked protesters performed the Nazi salute on the steps of Victorian Parliament.
Nazi salutes. They've been doing that for the last, how long have they been here? 45 minutes an hour. Now they've moved closer to this rally here.
At least four states are now contemplating banning the gesture in public. But why are neo-Nazis and others on the far right getting so involved in transgender issues?
Well, I'd say that it's one of many issues that is explosive for the far right, because the far right extremists, they are opportunists.
Lisa Waldeck is with Macquarie University's Department of Security Studies and Criminology.
As we saw in other issues around COVID, for example, you know, identity issues, and particularly the way that it's currently being framed, this idea of the anti-trans movement within the schooling setting, so you kind of saw that kind of focus, taps into communities' concerns, lack of understanding, lack of, you know, miscommunications. You know, when you talk about issues around children, emotions are raised. And when you talk about issues of identity, emotions are raised. And therefore, you know, as we saw in Melbourne, there's an opportunity for individuals in the far-right extremist space to come forward in so-called support of these concerns, fears. And it doesn't necessarily lead to them being the same thing, but it is an opportunity, again, to exploit, to make sure that people are talking about them and not the actual underpinning concern.
Several of these rallies were held in conjunction with speeches by Kelly J. Keane Minchell, a British anti-transgender campaigner who is also known as Posy Parker.
This is British activist Kelly J. Keane Minchell. She's been appearing at anti-transgender rights rallies across Australia. She says she is calling for women's rights, but those who oppose her coming here say her message is one of hate.
What role has she played, and you know, has she been a catalyst, I guess, for bringing these groups together?
I think that she represents an opportunity for these groups to take centre stage. She certainly provides a space that brings together lots of different people who feel very strongly for or against these issues. And therefore, that is an opportunity for exploitation by groups within the far-right extremist space. Whether that is her intention or not, absolutely can't comment on that. But when you have a controversial individual coupled with a controversial issue, it creates opportunity for exploitation.
So what do we know about the groups themselves? How organised are they?
Well, I think that there is clearly a degree of organisation. You know, you saw that within the Melbourne events, the events that took place in Melbourne. This wasn't just an ad hoc collection of people in Melbourne. I will just add that this is still a tiny minority within a minority of individuals. So, you know, I think the media reporting puts it at about 30 people who, from the far right extremist, that could be identified in terms of their costume.
Yeah, these were the men dressed in black, many of them masked and giving the Nazi salute.
Yeah, and so that is indicative of a degree of organisation, again, exploiting an opportunity. But I think we have to focus on the fact that not as much as it was horrific, it was also a very small number of people. Mm. You know, this isn't a kind of everything everywhere. We've still got to keep it in. As horrific as it is, and it is horrific for many different reasons, it's still very small. This isn't kind of a mass movement.
Now, in response, a few states have moved to ban the Nazi salute. Is that going to make anyone safer?
To be perfectly honest, no, it's not. But and this isn't to say whether it's a good thing or a bad thing, but I think rather than asking the question is it making us safer, it's what's the purpose of a government banning symbology associated with groups whose ambition is to overthrow liberal democracy, whether through peaceful or violent means, depending on where you are in the kind of landscape. So I don't think the ambition is to make us safer in that kind of, yes, it's a safer thing, no, it's a safer, because I think that asks too much of the legislation. Mm. I think we need to think about what's the purpose of this legislation, who is the audience intended to? Is the purpose far-right groups themselves? No, I think, you know, other people have spoken eloquently on the fact that you ban something, these groups simply adopt other symbology. You ban something, something else comes up. Banning things doesn't solve a problem. It is but a plaster, and you have to ask yourself whether or not it's an appropriate time to put on a plaster, I guess. Mm. But is it potentially a useful tool for those in law enforcement? Is it a useful tool for raising conversations around the importance of democratic values and what they are and how we're going to protect them? Possibly, yes.
Mm. Is there an argument that these groups, which as you say are opportunists, and crave attention, that this is exactly what they want, that they aim to shock and be talked about, and perhaps even by doing this interview and, you know, we're assisting them in that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that ultimately when we think about violent extremism and we think about its purpose and its agenda, it's a form of communication. And the aim is to create overreactions within government, to generate fear within society, and also to make sure that you project a degree of strength, a degree of power, and get your message out there. You know, it's one of the reasons why violent extremism is, as a tactic, incredibly powerful. And it does exactly what we're doing now. It helps people, the groups, to gain publicity, and it's a really fine balance, isn't it, David? I really, you know, struggle with this a lot around to what extent should we be talking about these issues, to what extent should we not be talking about them, and not giving groups the groups that we saw over in Melbourne kind of time. And I think it's always a difficult balance, but I think one of the most important things is to raise it as a question, because it does make us think about how we present those groups, how we report on them, how we think about them, and ultimately how we engage and deal with the problem that they pose to democratic society.
Lisa Waldeck there from Macquarie University. After months of negotiation, an emotional Anthony Albanese this week announced the wording for the Voice referendum.
I'm not here to occupy the space, to change who's in the white car. I'm here to change the country.
Australians will vote this year on whether a Voice to Parliament and government, which would act as an independent advisory body for First Nations people, should be enshrined in the Constitution. And standing with Indigenous leaders, the Prime Minister choked back tears as he made the announcement.
And there's nowhere more important than changing the country, than changing our nation's constitution to recognise the fullness of our history. So I want this done for Indigenous Australians, but I want it done for all Australians. We will feel better about ourselves if we get this done. We'll just feel better.
But efforts to fine-tune the wording of the question have done little to allay concerns for opponents, including some Indigenous leaders.
The truth is, it is treating Indigenous Australians as separate to the rest of Australia. We are Australian citizens, and for those of us who don't agree with the campaign, we don't want to be divided along the lines of race, which is what this is doing.
So what happens next? Dana Morse is a political reporter with the ABC.
It really was emotional. I mean, it's not often that you see the Prime Minister, government ministers and senior Indigenous leaders all crying on stage, but this is a moment that's decades in the making for a lot of them. I mean, people like Marcia Langton and Tom Calmer, who have been working on this for years and years and years and have been denied so many times by so many different prime ministers before getting to this point where we finally have, you know, a form of words that's going to go to the public. It's a real moment of recognition for them that this has been an absolute slog. It's far from over, but you know, it would be very difficult not to reflect on what they have seen in their lifetimes, all the bodies that have come and gone, all of the gaps that still haven't closed. And this is finally what they believe is the best chance to have action on that. And it's something that weighs heavily on all of them.
So to the substance of the announcement, we now have a form of words that will be put to the Australian people and a form of words, a proposed form of words, that would change the constitution. Now, there's been some minor changes to those words, to that wording. Why have they changed from what was announced by the Prime Minister last year?
Yeah, so the biggest change has been in the question. That's really had a proper top-to-tail rewrite. And the reason for that is that the question has to link to the referendum machinery bill. And there are sort of some legalese that has to go in there to put those two pieces together. So that's why the question has gone from being, do you support an Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voice, yes or no, to this quite wordy, a proposed law to alter the constitution to recognise the First Peoples of Australia by establishing a voice. Do you approve this proposed alteration? That's all to do with the legalities of how the Machinery Act works in a referendum. When we then look at the proposed alteration to the constitution, and you've got those four sentences, the main changes have been on the third sentence, which now says that the voice may make representations to the parliament and executive government of the Commonwealth. There was a lot of back and forth over that over the course of the 8 or 10 months that the referendum working group has been looking at these words. There were suggestions at some point to take executive government out altogether. They've landed on saying, you know, executive government of the Commonwealth to define that they want it to be broader than just the parliament, but they don't want it to be going down into the state and territories. They'll have their own processes. So that's been the main change of those words.
So why was there so much back and forth? What were the constitutional and other concerns, and have they been alleviated here?
Well, it depends who you ask. The constitutional experts are really split on this. We even saw from within the constitutional expert group, some of the loudest voices out of that have been people like Greg Craven, and he really believes that leaving executive government in will be the death knell of the referendum. But then on the other hand, you've got experts like Anne Toomey who say that's not the case at all. And the whole issue is around the High Court. So essentially their concern is that if the voice gives advice to the government, executive, etc., and it's not taken on board, can they then go to the High Court and say, we have the right to give this advice and it has not been taken? And some of the constitutional conservatives think it's going to create this legal minefield where everything gets tied up in a protracted court battle. Now, Anne Toomey and others believe that is not the case. They don't think that that is a real concern of substance at all.
Yeah, it certainly sounds very complex, and I guess that's part of the reason that the coalition says it wants more information. So what exactly is Peter Dutton calling for now?
Peter Dutton wants the government to release the Solicitor General's advice that was given to the referendum working group, I believe, a couple of weeks ago, and that was over the executive government clause.
That would be pretty unusual, though, wouldn't it? Governments rarely, if ever, release the internal advice they get from the Solicitor General.
It has happened before, but you're right, it is really unusual. And the government has said that. They've said, you know, this is highly irregular. It essentially falls to the Prime Minister and the Attorney General as to whether they want to do that. It's an interesting situation that they're in, because should they release that advice and it says that executive government shouldn't be in, then Peter Dutton has a reason not to support The Voice. But if they don't release the advice, then it looks like they're not being transparent. So they're in a tricky position either way.
Anthony Albanese says he's now all in, that he's kind of tied himself to this referendum. So what is now at stake for him, and will he be blamed personally if this fails?
I think it's hard to see that he wouldn't be blamed in some way if the referendum fails. It might not necessarily be fair, but when you have, as he has, essentially brought this up as the foundation, central policy to his government and his prime ministership, if it doesn't get up, people will be looking at why that is and what his impact on that was. It's really difficult to change the constitution in Australia. We have 8 successful referendums out of 44 since 1901. So it's really tricky. And experts were saying earlier today, you know, the last time we had a contested referendum where it was a bit controversial and it passed was 1946. So this is a really, really big swing that he's taking. And you can tell that he feels the weight of it. I mean, that's why he was getting emotional in the press conference, because he does feel the weight of needing to progress this voice, needing to recognise Indigenous people as the first people of Australia. And he would very much be aware of what will happen if it does fail.
Dana Morse there, a political reporter with ABC. Well, it's been a long time between drinks for New South Wales Labor. The state's had 4 different premiers since 2011, none of them from the ALP. But are the coalition's fortunes about to change? As voters go to the polls, Premier Dominic Perrottet is battling a challenge from Labor leader Chris Minns.
This election is a very important election. We're in difficult economic times. Inflation is rising, interest rates are rising, businesses are worried, and jobs are at risk.
This election campaign will come down to 2 big questions. Which party is going to reform and repair schools and hospitals in New South Wales? And which party is going to stand up against privatisation in the state of New South Wales?
They may sound like pretty standard election pitches, but there's a lot to this contest which is rather unconventional and could have implications for every state in the country. Professor Andy Marks is a political scientist and a pro-vice chancellor at Western Sydney University.
Dominic Perrottet really rose up through the ranks of the Liberal Party, from the Young Liberals through to the right faction. His time in government has been, you know, in the main spent as treasurer. So he was treasurer under Gladys Berejiklian, the previous premier. And he's been, in some eyes, I guess, a premier in waiting. But the way he was able to do that is quite interesting, because as a warrior of the right faction, he was able to bring in support from the moderates to get that top job. And that really came in the form of his treasurer, Matt Keane, who's about as moderate as they get in the New South Wales Liberals.
That seems to have shaped his policy since he became premier as well, because, you know, there were some who looked at him as a sort of deeply conservative figure, but he's been pretty pragmatic in government, hasn't he?
Perrottet watched the results of the federal election very closely, and I think that with his treasurer, Matt Keane, they've worked really hard to address those issues that aren't characteristic of the right. So they've launched some very big initiatives around sustainability and clean energy transition. They've done a whole range of measures to bring in women into the workforce in greater numbers. So they're really trying to get a little bit of shape that's more of the moderate vein of the party, and an attempt to counter that teal wave that we saw last year.
His opponent is Chris Minns of the Labor Party. What defines him, and how are voters likely to see him?
Chris Minns is really defined by behaviour that's uncharacteristic of opposition. In Australian politics, federally and around the states, In recent years, opposition's been characterised by a pretty combative style. Minns has been a conciliator. He's been someone that's very much about acknowledging when the government gets something right and not engaging in conflict for conflict's sake.
I do like him. I do like him. I just don't want people to vote for him. But no, he's a nice person and we do get on. I think the campaign's been really civil and I think that's been good for democracy in New South Wales.
Like Perrottet, Minns came up through the ranks of Young Labor, but he's also, I guess somebody that's questioned Labor's close affiliations with the union movement. He said that we need a broader pattern of membership and he's since walked that back a little bit. But he's somebody that's probably uncharacteristic of a Labor leader as well.
So we've got a premier of the Conservative Party who's not acting like a Conservative and an opposition leader who's not acting like an opposition leader. The issues, cost of living, I mean, it's always a big election issue, whatever election you're talking about. But right now, you'd have to say it's a burning issue. So how have the leaders sought to capitalise on that?
Look, cost of living, you know, wherever you are, is impacting. And I think both of them, you know, have had that at the core of their campaign promises, but it's really difficult to tell those promises apart. You know, they are very, very similar in the quantum of funding they direct to particular issues around toll rebates, for example, but they are different in the direction to which they steer that funding. You know, Perrottet is more about giving relief directly to households, whereas Minns is more about relief in the system. I think the issue for both leaders is to find points of differentiation around cost of living relief.
One of the policies the Premier Dominic Perrottet has put forward is this Future Fund for Children. Just explain what it is and how you think it's been received.
Look, this is a co-investment plan essentially, and it's asking parents and households to consider the future education and housing costs for their children, and it's offering a co-investment from government annually in a fund, the Education Future Fund, which children will be able to access when they turn 18.
When a child turns 18, they can use those funds to put towards the cost of education and housing, a powerful head start on the path to success.
The difference here is that Labor's offering comparable amounts of funding, but Labor's directing their funds straight into the school system. So it's a similar quantum again, but a different approach. And the challenge with the Perrottet approach is that, you know, there's some critics have suggested that some households may not be able to mount a co-investment of the level required to get the maximum amount out of this fund. And the other element of that fund that Perrottet's set up is that it can also be used for housing, whereas the education fund that Labor is proposing is one that's, as I said, direct into schools.
And one of the policies that made a big splash for Chris Minns, the Labor leader, was, as you mentioned, this toll relief. Why is toll relief such a big issue in Sydney in particular, and how do you think that's landed?
Well, I think for Sydney-siders, congestion, like in any major city around the country, is front of mind when you're trying to get to and from work. But the way that the Sydney system has been funded, the road system, that is probably key to this challenge we have around tolls. You know, I think the Perrottet government has made a cornerstone of privatisation, or they call it asset recycling, whereby, you know, they've been able to fund major infrastructure, but they've done so in partnership with industry. And the result is that we have tolls run by the private sector across the entire roads network. And it's not uncommon in some of the worst commutes in Sydney to pay upwards of $200, $250 a week in tolls. It has made commute times a little easier, the kind of rollout of all of this infrastructure, but Sydney-siders are paying for it and it's a really hot-button issue at this election.
And it's flowed on to the issue of privatisation, hasn't it, and whether or not assets will be sold off in the future.
That's right. And Minns has kind of cornered Perrottet on the issue of privatisation. So Minns made a very big point early on in the campaign of saying that, you know, we'll be paying for some of these motorways four or five times over through the life of the toll agreements. And he argued that this is no sustainable way to fund infrastructure moving forward. And he's committed not to funding some particular metro and other projects should they win government unless they can mount a case for sustainable investment. To counter that, Perrottet walked back what's been nearly a decade's worth of Liberal and Coalition commitment to privatisation, and he has assured voters there will be no further privatisation should he be returned to government. That's very significant because that has been the core behind the delivery of major projects in Western Sydney and in New South Wales more broadly.
Well, Sydney's certainly known for toll roads, but New South Wales as a state is also very well known, not for always good reasons, for pokies. And cashless gaming is one of the issues where there's this now clear point of difference between the two parties. Dominic Perrottet has taken on the powerful clubs industry. He's promising to introduce the reform, while Chris Minns has promised a more limited trial of the technology. Is this issue, do you think, shifting votes, and how has it shaped this campaign?
It is an issue that's actually taken a lot of the electorate by surprise. And I think for Perrottet, he's played it quite effectively in giving himself some moral shape. You know, he's using his stance against gambling to show that, you know, he will take a stand on issues of a social nature. Gambling-related harm, particularly in Sydney and Western Sydney, is an incredibly damaging thing for communities and families. And I think it won't be gambling reform that turns the election, but it will certainly contribute to that kind of shape that we have around Perrottet. And that's significant for a figure like him who's been in the dry old world of Treasury for a very long time and, you know, who has been cast as a conservative. It says, well, look, actually, he's prepared to move on particular issues. Minns has struggled in that respect.
So speaking of gambling, what's your money on in terms of the result? Who do you think will win and what will the parliament look like after this election?
Look, if you believe the polls, we're likely heading for a Labor minority. So the crossbench will come into play and Labor will have to negotiate. But I just have to look at the way that polling's been thoroughly discredited, certainly since the 2019 federal election, where they got it completely wrong. And I really don't think this one's going to be easy to predict, but there you go. I wriggled off the hook on that one.
You're a wise man. That's Professor Andy Marks there from Western Sydney University. And that's the episode for this week. You can subscribe or leave us a review if you like. This Week is produced by Madeline Jenner, Nick Grimm, Anna John and me, David Lipson.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.